I'm Christopher Lydon, listening for one remarkable young Afghan writer's impressions of boyhood in heaven and then civil war in hell, with a glimpse and a guess perhaps about what's coming in Afghanistan next as its American phase comes to an end. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Qais Akbar Omar is my friend by now. He's a rug maker and an entrepreneur, and he's on his way to becoming a novelist. His memoir of an Afghan childhood is titled A Fort of Nine Towers, for the refuge in Kabul where his family hid out together in the worst days of holy gangsterism in Kabul. Qais, so many contrasts and contradictions in this story. Grandpapa and family sagas and songs and rituals and kite-cutting contests. Papa, the boxing teacher. The whole extended family with nomadic traditions too and a great house in the city. And then cut to thievery and murder, cults of killing and torture, mad dogs set upon you to tear you apart. It's incredible. It's almost unfathomable. But start with those family travels in this story, on the run sometimes and sometimes under pressure of war, but they would make any Huckleberry Finn's heart race with excitement. Transport us to Bamyan province and what that family was going through.
Well, the civil war started in Kabul. We had to leave Kabul to find a way to get out of the country. So we went to Bamyan. And when we went to Bamyan, I've heard about that place so many times from my grandfather. When he was, as a kid, he used to go and climb the mountain, the Buddhas, and he used to, his uncles and his father used to sell the wool to local people who made kilims and carpets back 100 years ago. And he told the stories to me and my cousins all the time, and I was always, wanted to go there. But I was only 7 or 8 years old back then, so waiting for my chance one day for my grandfather to take me there and show me all his favorite places. And here, unexpectedly, we ended up in Bamyan. And it was just amazing to just stand in the front of the statues of Buddha. So beautiful. And the thing is so big, like 52 meters tall, and it looks like as if the Buddhas are about to walk out. And so I was standing there admiring it, and my father told us, "Do you want to climb the Buddha?" And my five sisters and I looked at my mom, and we all said, "Yes," very excitedly. So he said, "Let's climb the Buddha." Then we climbed from this, inside the, from the foot, there is a stair that carved inside the mountain that you can climb all the way to the shoulder and then to the back and then to the head. And there are caves behind, and they are all so beautiful, the caves. Well, not anymore, though, because the Taliban destroyed them.
It's part of what we're supposed to hold against the Taliban.
Yeah.
And you do too, I'm sure.
Oh, very much so, very much so. So 2 years later, when we saw the short clip on TV, that how they were blown away, I was so heartbroken. I think I cried. And I think we just, in Afghanistan, you don't show much emotion. You just keep it to yourself. You have to be tough. You have to be man. You have to hold everything inside you and deal with it. But things like that, you can't. You have to let, So, and the same thing, I think my parents and my sisters, they feel the same way. So I believe once we lived in the head of the Buddha, and now the Buddha lives in our heads.
Explain the meaning of that just sheer destructive gesture from the Taliban. What were they saying, and how did your heart read it?
Well, the Taliban, as everybody knows, dark-minded people, they said that Afghanistan is an Islamic country. Well, that was the way Taliban acted. They always made that this very theatrical big scene to get a lot of attention. Like, they will kill someone in the middle of the stadium, Kabul stadium, and which turned into an execution center, and to make a dramatic scene to draw a lot of attention, or they will hang someone in the middle of the roundabout in the for 2-3 days, so everybody walks by and sees that this man was was hanged there for whatever, for the crime he made. It was a way of telling people that they are in charge. They will cut a hand in public to show that nobody can steal anymore. It was how they tried to show that they are in charge and they have the power and nobody can mess with them.
There's a great turning point in your book, Kais, where I think of it as the moment where thugs force their way into your grandfather's house and he stares them down and says, "I'm praying and I'll deal with you in good time." But they do prevail and they take his rugs, they take his everything. And the nightmare begins. Take us into that. It ends in this almost unbelievable horror show where bandits have captured you and they're actually sicking dogs on you. And you've told me you've got scars still of the dog bites that could easily have destroyed you. I mean, take us there.
Well, when the Mujahideen after the Soviet were defeated by the seven factions that I have to talk a little about before that to make my point here. When the Soviets came to Afghanistan in 1979, they were there for 10 years. During those 10 years, the Americans formed seven factions in Pakistan, which now they are called the Northern Alliance. So those seven factions defeated the Soviet Union. And then the Soviets were out of Afghanistan. Then they came to Kabul. As soon as they came to Kabul for 7 months, life was very easy and simple, and everybody was happy. And I used to hear from the grown-ups, like my father and uncles and grandfather, that our brother Mujahideens are back, are now here, and they are gonna run this country, and we will have a peaceful and Islamic country and happy. So for 7 months, we had pretty good life. It was nice and easy to travel all over the country. But then, civil war, these seven factions, they were so disorganized that they all wanted to run the country, each one. One wanted to be the next president or the prime minister or the minister of defense or foreign affairs minister. And they did not get along with each other. They had a lot of money and weapons, so they started firing rockets to each other. Each captured a town, a neighborhood in Kabul, and start sending rockets to each other. And as a result, a large number of, also when they came to Kabul, they overran the Policharchi prison, and they freed a lot of criminals. And those criminals took arms, and they formed their own factions in Kabul. Then we tried. We thought that the civil war will only last for probably a few months, and then they will come to a solution, and they will do something about it. But that civil war lasted for 5 years. So one day, probably it was one of the factions or one of the people who was freed from the prison who took arms. They came to our house, knocked the door, and I opened the door, and he said, "Where is your grandfather?" And I said, "He's in his room." And he pushed me and went all the way to his room and opened the door, and my grandfather was on his prayer rack praying, and they pointed gun at his head and saying, "Give me the key." And my grandfather did not even pay attention. He just continued his prayer. When he finished, he folded his prayer rag and put it on the side as if nobody's in the room and nothing disturbed him. A man who didn't know what fear meant, which is how he taught us too. He said, "Don't be afraid of anything. Let other things be afraid of you, or let people be afraid of you." So it's like you make the decision, like whether someone be afraid of you or not. So he is just like those guys have gun, and my grandfather doesn't have anything, his prayer rack, and he just put there, and then he looked at them as if he was talking to his customer in the bank. He used to work as an in Afghanistan National Bank. So he looked at them and he said, "What?" And he said, "Give me the key to your warehouse." And my father said, "I'm not going to give you the key." And then they start shouting, and my grandfather said that, "If you think you scare me with your loud voice, save your breath. that's not gonna, you know, do anything. So by then, my uncles and my aunts and everybody were in the room, and they could not do anything because these guys had guns. So they could not kill all of us, and they just said, "You stupid man!" Looked at my father and, you know, pointed the gun to us to just let them walk out of the room. And they did walk out of the room, and they. 2 minutes later, we heard that they shot the lock of the warehouse outside. And my uncle and my grandfather, and we all ran outside to see what happened. And they were shot the first lock, and they were on the second lock trying to shoot it. And then they did. And then they pointed the guns at us. And then in front of us, they stole everything we owned, over, 6,000 carpets. And that's how we start losing everything. And we thought, okay, this is what we expected of these people is not going to happen. So we better find a way to get out of this country, which is why my father decided with his children, myself and my five sisters and my mom, to get out of the country, and then he will find a way to get the rest of the family out of Afghanistan. So everywhere we went, war chased us, and we ended up in the next place, So,
from that moment when they invaded your grandfather's house, though, it's thuggery at a high level everywhere, except for one amazing moment when one of the thugs said, wait a sec, your father was my boxing teacher.
Yeah.
And I owe him something. I owe him respect.
Yeah. We moved from our house to my father's friend's house on the other side of the mountain. Like every 2 months or 3 months, my father or my grandfather wanted to just go and visit our house to see still if the walls are still standing, or if my grandfather planted over 100 Macintosh apple trees in his garden, and he was so much in love with them, with his rose bushes, that he spent so many hours every day around them, keeping them in good shape while he was singing under his teeth or whispering the 99 names of God, meditating while he was tending his flowers or his garden. And then he was just living on the other side of the mountain with the rest of the family, and he was away from his garden, he lost everything, all his wealth, but still his house was his pride, and he wanted to go and see. So whenever we went there, one time, the first time my grandfather and I went there, and we saw a lot of things that changed since, like, you know, all the houses in our neighborhood, they were all shattered. There was not a single house that was not hit by one or several rockets, and the windows were all broken. Cats were just walking out of the window, jumping from one roof to another roof, and dogs were everywhere in a state of eating. They were holding, a hand or a leg of a human, running from one place to another place, because the whole place was filled with dead bodies. So much has, changed over the past 7 or 8 months, as if that nobody lived in our neighborhood for centuries. That's what war does to a place. So we went there to see our house, and we were captured by people, by the factions who were, had the neighborhood in control, and they put us in a room in one of our neighbor's house, where there was a ditch in the middle of the courtyard. It was filled with dead bodies of, human heads. And when we were in prison in that room next to the ditch, there were things written on walls like, "Once you walk in this room, you will not walk out alive," because my brother was the example of it, and I'll be the next. Really, really grim stuff written with charcoal or with a chalk on the wall. And my grandfather looked at me, and he saw that I was reading them, and it had a huge effect on me, and I started to cry, or tears rolling out of my eyes. I could not cry in front of my grandfather, of course. But then he wrote, just write down on the wall something like, it's written in the book, but I want to say it from the memory, that death is like a cage, and when you die, you're freed from the cage. So that made it so easy. I felt like I was a bird being, you know, caged with life in this world. So if I die, I'm free. And it was so poetic and so powerful and so easy to just understand, and suddenly changed my whole concept of living and dying. And but of course, my grandfather said that to make me feel happy. He was a wise man like that. He said a lot of wise things like that. And we are about to be killed, I think, the next minute when this guy showed up. And then he said, "Who are you?" He was the commander of that neighborhood. And my grandfather said, "I came to see my house. And this is my grandson, Qais." And he said, "Is that your house?" And my grandfather said, "Yes." And then he said, "That's my teacher's house. And he's a good man. He used to be my boxing trainer. And he's physics teacher at Habibi High School. He's a great man. He helped me a great deal." And my grandfather said, "Well, he's my son. Are you talking about Abdul Basir?" And he said, "Yes, teacher Abdul Basir, Malam Abdul Basir." Malam means teacher. And my grandfather said, "Yeah, he's my son." And he said, "No, you're lying, old man. And well, I can tell you a few things about him. He had a very big motorcycle, and he sold it, and he bought a Russian Volga. Do you want me to tell you about his favorite food, favorite clothes, favorite color? And he's a boxer. He went to these many countries and came back with good medals for this country, and the whole country is proud of him." Things like that. And then suddenly the man realized that he was talking to his favorite teacher's father, and he started kissing my grandfather's hand. So that's how we were freed that time. And then he was very nice and hospitable and kind and warm and welcoming. But then he told us his story, why he did all those, you know, gruesome things. His whole family was killed by the opposite faction. He told us all their stories, that his brother or his cousin was pumped with air in his ass until he exploded. So stuff like that. And his mom and his sisters were right in front of him and then killed, stuff like that. So and that's why he just made him, and he was just suspicious of anyone who walked into the neighborhood, thinking that they were spying on him, even though when they were just normal local people trying to come to visit their house to see if the walls like us are still standing, if their house is still in good shape, or if they can take something if it is left to where they are living on the other side of Kabul. And so things like that, you know, several things like that happen to us, and each time we are close to being killed and we are saved by a miracle. It was always a family tie or a family connection or a friend or someone that we knew, or we did something good to someone in the past and that became a tool to save us.
Qais, let me ask you, because I know you think about this kind of thing. I'm thinking of the Black and Decker phase in the Iraq War, where people were drilling each other's brains out. I mean, a complete breakdown of humanity. There was an officer there who said to me, "Chris, read Thucydides on the civil war at Corsara in ancient Greece. Something snaps in a world and people are doing utterly outrageous, unimaginable cruelties to each other." Do you have an idea of sort of where it begins or how it happens?
I just still can't make sense of it. I just don't know why people do those things to each other. I still, you know, I lived all my life in Afghanistan, and I've seen quite a lot of things that I shouldn't have seen for my age. And I don't think anyone should see those things in their life. I still can't understand why people can be so bad, why they can be so cruel, why they can how they can, what they feel torturing other people, I just still don't understand. And I don't think anyone in my family really understands. Every time we see like suicide bombers killing themselves and hundreds of other people around them, I don't know what drives them to do stuff like that. Or, you know, torturing people, you know, hitting nails on their head, or raping women, or you just name it. All of those things happen in Afghanistan, and I've seen quite a lot of them, but I still don't understand why they do them.
What's going through a boy's mind when dogs, vicious, man-killing dogs, are charging at him under the encouragement of these people who had captured you?
Well, there was one place in the book that I had to go and steal some pomegranates and because we had nothing else to eat. And I'm in the garden and it's at night, and I just had a bag of pomegranate and I dropped it over the wall, and I'm about to climb the walls that when the dogs, you know, run at me, and they were barking, and I just cannot see which direction they are coming at me. So before I knew, they're right in front of me and about to attack me. So I just stood my ground and kept looking at them. And I could see in their eyes that as soon as I felt something a little scared, they came one step ahead. As soon as I felt like confident that no, they are big and they are strong and they probably will tear me apart. But as soon as I just looked into their eyes, they stopped barking at me, just but making that sound that they are about to attack. So suddenly I just turned around and tried to climb the walls that when one of the dogs just attacked and just bite on my leg, and the pain was so, you know, just unbelievable. But I had to be brave, thinking of my grandfather, that you don't shout, you don't cry. But at the same time, thinking of my grandfather, who told us all, you know, from the very early age, three things you don't do in life: stealing, lying, and killing people. And then here I was, just stole pomegranates. And I say, and I thought at that moment, still the dog is biting my leg, and I'm about, you know, I'm trying, struggling to get over the wall and jump on the other side, thinking that, oh, my grandfather was right. Here it is. I'm paying for my crime. I'm paying for my, you know, the things that I was strictly forbidden to not do. And here it is happening to me.
I mean, you got through these things with the light of your grandfather. But I wonder, you know, do you relive them? Do you ever get over them?
I don't think you will ever get over them in your life. It's always there. It's part of you, even though they all happened in the past. But past is what makes, you know, you. That left me, you know, kind of shattered for days. And sometimes I was haunted by these dreams at night, and that left me shattered for days or weeks, and I couldn't do anything. I just had to, you know, deal with it. But talking about it was like a therapy. We don't have therapy or psychiatrists in Afghanistan. It was my way of getting rid of a lot of things that I held on myself. I think every Afghan in Afghanistan needs a therapy or a psychiatrist to go and talk about their past, which is why we have a large number of people there suffering from depression now or some kind of mental illness. 2 years later, I think I saw something on TV that just, you know, brought a lot of things back. So that time I just went to my room and I just started to write just one scene from the past that was very vivid always in my mind. The part about my grandfather and myself when we were, you know, held as a prisoner in that house, and we saw the ditch full of dead bodies, and that was where I started it. So I just wrote like 10 pages, and then I couldn't stop. It just came in rush, and like, you know, flood, you can't stop it. And sometimes I was laughing and couldn't, you know, because I was back in the past with my grandfather telling jokes, talking about Mawlana Nasruddin, or he is reading poetry from his books, or reading passages from his most favorite book, Afghanistan and the Path of History, history book by Mir Ghulam Muhammad Ghubar, or reading Hafiz, or Omar Khayyam, or Rumi. Or I'm flying kites with my cousin Wakil on the roof, and or playing marble with my neighborhoods. So all of that was so beautiful. And so I just, you know, Afghans are storytellers. I think you can find best storytellers in Afghanistan. That's just in our blood. That's just part of the culture. And in the West, you have the culture of writing your stories and publishing them. Well, in my part of the world, we don't do that. My grandfather told a story to my father. My father will tell me, and I will tell my children. So you carry it on from heart to heart. And you slightly change it every now and again to apply it to your life, so you can benefit from it. So a story can have many versions, from the time it was first told until it came to my generation, which is probably like 100 generations later. And then from then on, after 2 months, I was in a very, very dark place for several months, because when you go through hardship in life, you just go through them one by one. And you know, one in a day, or one in a month, or several in a month, and you don't feel it so much. But when you try to write it, you relive them all together at the same time in a very short period of time. So you feel a lot. You literally feel the pain on your back when you're beaten by the Taliban, for example, or you can you think that you just touch that dead body on the ground, like you did when you're, you know, 10 years old, and you feel how it feels. So you just kind of live through them all over again, and it's very, very painful, but it's a very healthy process at the same time. And it's true. No matter how many times you talk about the past, writing about it is totally different, because talking about it, you just talk about it and it just passes very quickly. Writing, you take your time and you choose your word to write, to describe that particular scene, and that gives you a lot of time to go back into the past and, you know, just leave all of those moments together.
Kais, Americans are deeply engaged now in the fate of Afghanistan, willy-nilly. President Obama took us deeper in. He says we'll be out by next year. A lot of us wonder why we were there in the first place. But give us your sense of what's next in Afghanistan, and most particularly how the United States withdraws in something like a constructive way.
This is a question that everybody asks me at home when I call them every once a week or twice a week through Skype, and they ask me what's going to happen after 2014. We just don't know what's going to happen after 2014. I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen after Americans pull out of Afghanistan in 2014. But one thing we know is that we don't and we can't afford another war or a civil war. Afghans are very, very tired of war. We had it for 30 years. One thing Afghans talk about often, that the Europeans and Americans owe Afghanistan this much to bring peace in this country, for defeating the Soviets and for ending the Cold War between the US and the Soviet, and ending the Cold War between the UK and Soviets, and freeing Eastern Europe when the Soviets were defeated by these seven factions. So the world, we believe, owes Afghanistan and Afghans this much to bring peace to that country, to return peace to that country.
How would Americans do it? And who else could be, should be, might be engaged, including China, including India, including Iran?
Well, the problem in Afghanistan is not military. There is no military solution to problem in Afghanistan. That I just can tell you, because no matter who Americans or anyone fights in Afghanistan, it's not going to end. It's just, you know, read the history books. Nobody wins in Afghanistan. That's just the reality. If you fight Afghans or any group in Afghanistan for eternity, they resist and fight back for eternity. Alexander the Great could not fight Afghanistan, so who anyone thinks that he or she can, you know, fight Afghans? So the base way in Afghanistan, the solution to Afghanistan is economical problem. The solution economic. If you can provide them job, they will not join the Taliban or any of these factions. If they have a regular job to go every day, we have so much in this country need to be fixed or need to be built. Like, we don't have proper roads. You can put a lot of people on building roads. We don't have sewage system at all. You can put a lot of people into work doing that. Basic infrastructure. We don't have water system. We don't have electricity. We are borrowing electricity. We are buying electricity from Turkmenistan and Tajikistan for the past 3-4 years. And most of the major cities in Afghanistan don't have even electricity. While we have 20 micro hydro dams, big hydro dams in Afghanistan, all need to be fixed. So if you put a lot of people in work and give them job, they have no reason to go and join either the Taliban or the factions or any warlord or drug lord group. They will, you know, everybody wants to have a chance at life. They want to have the same thing what you have in this country. You know, a house, a job, good school, good roads, electricity, water, just basic stuff. And that's the solution to Afghanistan, I believe. And I believe many Afghans feel the same way.
Last question for me, Qais. Do we know how to break the imperial cycle that is a huge part of the problem? William Dalrymple has written a wonderful book on the First Afghan War, in which Afghans repelled the Brits in 1842. In come the Russians, out go the Russians, in come the Americans, guns blazing, we're about to leave now. In William Dalrymple's book, he meets tribal chiefs who say, next it'll be China, and we'll deal with them too. But there's this sense of nobody ever learns the lesson that the Afghans will not be dominated militarily, and they won't. Do we know how to break that cycle of providing aid, some piece of modernity that they want, and then getting out of the way?
Well, the base way to succeed in Afghanistan is a lesson we should learn from Alexander the Great. He was stuck there for 3 years, and then he couldn't get out of that country. And then he married one of the local people, Rukhshana, and then he made family with them, and then the Afghans let them pass. And then he had a big jirga. Jirga is a big national assembly with the heads of the local town, and then that's how they let them pass. So for centuries, Afghanistan ran that way. I'm not expecting every American to go and marry an Afghan woman. That's not going to happen.
Would we be happy?
Except it's not Afghan culture, so that's a different... I don't want to go to that direction. But the way it works in Afghanistan is that... with the local shura or jirga, this is how it works. You invite the head of the towns or the head of the each tribe, and you sit together in a big mosque. Whether it takes 1 day or 1 month, you talk about it. You come to a solution, and then you go for the next thing. And then everybody's happy, everybody's agreed on one thing, and then they'll go and do that. I wonder why nobody has done that. The best way to succeed in Afghanistan is to talk to all these people. Militarily, you know, you fight with them for centuries, they fight back. That's the problem. Afghanistan is 75% mountain, and every Afghan who fights back believes that he's a children of, you know, he is a child of the mountain. So how can you fight with a mountain and with the children of the mountain? It just doesn't work that way. The best way is to just go with the tradition of jirga and shura, that people come together, talk about it. Where is the problem? What is the solution? Where is the solution that everybody benefits from? And then let's go for that. And then everybody's happy. You have your share, I have my share, you benefit, I benefit, and we're all happy, and we're all, you know, having a peaceful life. That's the only solution.
So glad you wrote this book. Qais Akbar Omar's memoir of an Afghan childhood is called A Fort of Nine Towers. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until listeners like you make a comment or a question or extend the conversation on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the project.